Today on The Grave Talks, the Ma Barker House. The Ma Barker House is a product of the criminal dark times of the Depression and Prohibition. Its storied history links it back to the Barker criminal family of the time. Criminal activity, including bank robberies, kidnapping, and other traumatic events, were inflicted on those who crossed the Barker family's path along their way. Eventually, the FBI would catch up to the gang, ending in carnage. It would be known as the largest FBI shootout in history, holding that title to this day. What exactly happened after the dramatic shootout? What's the full story of the Ma Barker House, and do the Barkers still reside there today?
To go into the story of the Ma Barker House, you really have to go back into the late 1920s, the early 1930s, and really get a feel for the social climate of the time. So what we had going on at that time was we had the Great Depression as well as Prohibition. And what that did, that led to an outbreak of criminal activity, both organized crime with regard to the Prohibition, but also gangs that would rove across the country, mainly hitting banks and other locations where large amounts of money were stored. So the prolific buildup of gangs during that time was extremely prevalent. So one of the larger gangs that emerged from that time was the Barker Karpus gang. Now, the members of that gang were varied, but the main members were the Barker family, and that included Ma Barker. Her name was Kate. Her original name was Arizona Kate Donnie Clark. She married George Barker and became Ma Barker to her boys. She had four sons. There were Freddie Barker, Doc Barker, Herman Barker, and Lloyd Barker. And they joined with a gentleman, a gang member, actually, I'm not going to call him a gentleman, another gang member named Alvin Karpus. And together, those boys, along with Ma and Alvin Karpus, really crisscrossed the country and wreaked havoc on banks and other large holdings where money were stored. What really got them into some hot water, however, was after the bank robberies and such didn't really yield what they were wanting in regards with returns, they started kidnapping. So the first person that they kidnapped was William Ham Jr., who was a brewer. And they got $100,000 from him. They returned him unharmed, but they did get $100,000 ransom. And after that, they decided to kidnap a gentleman by the name of Edward Bremer. Now, again, going back a little bit further during this time, there was very little state jurisdiction. So these gangs could crisscross jurisdictional lines and really didn't feel a whole lot of pressure from law enforcement because of that lack of jurisdiction. But around this time also, during the Edward Bremer kidnapping by the Barker Karpus gang, you have J. Edgar Hoover, who has come on the scene and who has started to standardize training and federal law enforcement. So he has the FBI going now, and he's got these standards and trainings, and he's got a group of FBI agents known as the Flying Squad. So they are actually going out and attempting to really rein in these larger gangs. So when the Barker Karpus gang, again led by Ma, kidnapped Edward Bremer, J. Edgar Hoover, this was a kidnapping that was near and dear to the president at the time. So he directed J. Edgar Hoover to go after the Barker Karpus gang. Feeling the heat from the FBI at that point, the Barker Karpus gang pretty much split up. They went in different directions to try to get the FBI heat off of them. So Doc Barker went to Chicago. And Ma and Fred Barker, at that point, went to a small town in Central Florida known as Ocklawaha. And they rented a house from a gentleman named Carson Bradford. Carson Bradford had this rental house on a lake called Lake Weir. So they decided to rent that house in the fall of 1934. So again, the FBI are after the gang at this point, and they end up tracking Doc Barker to an apartment in Chicago. And when they found him, they found some papers And in among those papers was a letter written by Ma, and it referenced a lake with an alligator named Big Joe. And so the lake was located in Central Florida. So the FBI went down to Central Florida, and they started talking to local alligator hunters and said, what lake in Central Florida has an alligator named Big Joe? And there's actually two of them. One was near the Gainesville area, and that didn't pan out because that alligator had actually been shot by hunters. The only other lake was a lake known as Lake Weir. And so the FBI agents decided to stake out that lake, and they noticed that there was a guy who was fishing, didn't look like your normal, you know, outdoor huntsman fisher type. So they kind of approached him and were making small talk with him, and come to find out that was Freddie Barker. So after they established that Ma and Fred were in the house, on the early morning of January 16th, 1935, a group of FBI agents, a dozen of them, surrounded this rental house, and they asked they yelled for the Barkers to come out, and the response they got was gunfire. And what ensued after that point was the largest FBI shootout in history, and it still maintains that that designation today. Over 2,000 bullets were fired during the hours of the shootout, and it culminated in Ma and Fred Barker actually being killed by the FBI. So that is really what put the Ma Barker house on the map in this little town, this nondescript town in Ocklawaha, Florida.
Did anyone in the town, I mean, what was the atmosphere in the town? Were they aware that these crime family members had taken up residence or taken up, safety in this house prior to the shootout?
Actually, they did not know that they were crime members.
Okay.
So Ma and Fred had rented the house under the name of T.C. Blackburn. And all indications were that they went out into the town. They were spending money. They were introducing themselves to the Blackburns. They would, somewhat socialize with some of the townspeople, not get too chummy, if you will. But no, they were out and about, and they just figured that they were so far removed from the FBI, from Washington and Chicago, and those larger Midwest towns where you would assume that they would hide out, that they really didn't, they didn't really try to lay low, if you would. So they did, all indications were they did spend money there. The townspeople knew them as the Blackburns. And during the shootout, actually, people came out and stood by the side of the road and watched the shootout as it unfolded.
Is there any record to indicate that the family there was maybe done with their criminal past and maybe trying to blend in and start a normal life or a life not crime ridden with the new names and going out into the community without kind of in the incognito mode, but not completely staying to themselves? Were they attempting to move on from that world, or was this just kind of a stop along the way for them, do you think?
That is a great question, and to answer it, no, they were not giving up the life of crime because this was all they knew.
Mm-hmm.
The boys started their criminal activity at a very young age, and Ma encouraged that criminal activity because she was reaping the benefits from it. So to go back to your question, they were actually using this house as a stopping point when the rest of the gang, they knew that Ma and Freddie were there. And so Alvin Karpis, who again was the major player in the gang, he was actually taking the ransom money that they had received from the Edward Bremer kidnapping, and he was using that as a stopping point, the house as a stopping point, to take that money down to Cuba and exchange it for quote-unquote clean money. So he would stop by the house, and even though they were only there for a couple of months, he would actually stop by the house on occasion and visit Ma and Fred and kind of use that as a stopping point on his way down into Cuba.
Okay.
So when they went into, after the shootout, when the FBI went into the house, Ma and Fred both had bug out bags, what we would call bug out bags today.
Mm-hmm.
They were packed and they had money. They actually had a large cache of weapons that they used to fire on the FBI. Again, the shootout lasted for several hours, over 6 hours.
Yeah.
So there were numerous guns. There was a lot of ammunition. So they were ready for the FBI, but they were caught unaware that morning. They didn't think it was going to be that quick that they were going to get caught, because they rented the house, like I said, in November of 1934, and the shootout happened January 16th, 1935.
Okay. So you have a house that is the site of the largest FBI shootout in history at that time, mm-hmm. and still holding the record to this day. I imagine a lot of bullet holes in a lot of things. And obviously just a property that is somewhat stigmatized with this happening on it. This happens way back then. What happens to the house right after the shootout with the rest of the townspeople? Obviously, it's still standing to this day, but take us back to right after the shootout. What do they do with the house?
So, to digress just a little bit, as I said before, the house was a vacation home, and it was built by a gentleman by the name of Carson Bradford. Mm-hmm. And initially, he did not want to rent the house out. It was for his family. He was from Tennessee originally, and he made his fortune in the amusement park industry. So he had built this as a vacation home, and other rentals in the area were going for about $7 to $15 a month. The Blackburns, a.k.a. Ma and Fred, actually said that they would rent the house for $100 a month. So he couldn't miss that opportunity. So he jumped on that opportunity, and they paid him in advance for 2 months. So obviously not knowing that he was renting it to one of the greatest crime families of the time. After the shootout, he had the foresight. He and his family had the foresight to really save a lot of the pieces of furniture and the artwork and stuff that were involved in the shootout. So if you go into the house today, you will still see bullet holes. The original furniture, a lot of it is still there. You can line up a chair, for example, that has bullet holes in the back to the bullet holes in the wall and see where the bullet has come through. Immediately after the shootout, people were enamored by the house. They wanted to go into the house. And the FBI quarantined it off for a couple of weeks, because Ma and Fred, their bodies actually laid in state in a funeral home in Ocala, Florida, for about 8 months because nobody would come and claim the bodies. So there was a fascination as the bodies lay in state there. There was a fascination with the bodies, with the house. But eventually, Carson Bradford, he still used it as a vacation home. Nobody ever really lived in it full time for a lot of years. The family did maintain it. And interestingly enough, in 2016, they decided they wanted to sell the property, and the new owners did not want the house. So Marion County actually said, we will take the house and we will move the house to a new location. So what they did in 2016, they actually put it on a barge and they floated it across Lake Weir to another location in a county park, and that's where it sits today.
Wow. So for all those years, it's a vacation house, literally from the 1920s on. Nobody's ever actually calling it home. And what a vacation house to go back to, I guess, when you're trying to get away riddled with bullet holes. So in the time period of it being a vacation house, obviously the interest of it, peaking way back with people enamored with this shootout and the crime family and the bodies and all that. Eventually that does simmer down, and it gets kind of, I'm assuming, becomes a legend of this is the house where that happened. And it sits, mm-hmm. and people Absolutely. Come and stay and go and all that. All the way back into those time periods, you're talking a massive window of time here, the 20s all the way up to, mm-hmm. to nearly present day. Was there any record? Was there any early stories or legends or anything that went on surrounding the house that pertain to it having paranormal activity of some sort? And if so, how far back does that go?
Absolutely. And I'll just say that, there was a fascination. And initially, after, a few years had passed, the city there actually started holding reenactments at the house. So they would hold reenactments on January 16th. And, they'd bring the guys dressed as the FBI agents with Tommy guns, mock Tommy guns, and they would stage these reenactments. And, I remember as a kid, because I grew up probably about 10 miles from that, from the house. And so when we would go to get the mail with, you know, my grandparents, we would pass it and they'd always say, you know, there's where Ma Barker died. So, you know, and again, Ocklawaha is a very, very small town in Marion County. So, so a lot of the local residents obviously knew the stories. A lot of them would go to the reenactments and, you know, probably, I want to say probably in the mid, 1980s, early 1990s is when they really kind of, the reenactments kind of simmered down. You know, a lot of that, that lore kind of faded, if you will. But, to your question on the paranormal, almost immediately people started reporting, paranormal activity. Some people would hear screaming from the house. Several people noted that they would be walking or driving by and they would see a woman figure standing on the back steps. There'd be people that would walk up to the house and they would hear, you know, get away or get out. Since the shooting, almost immediately there were reports of paranormal activity.
Now, with the activity of the house, obviously that tragic event occurring there, was there any history to the house prior to the shootout, other than it was a vacation house? I mean, is there any stories? I mean, obviously anything to do with this property is going to be overshadowed with the shootout and the crime family. But is there, I always like to try and put all the pieces of the puzzle together to see if there's anything else interesting there. What's the history? Is there any noise behind it?
No, there's not. In fact, the house was built only 2 years before the shootout.
Okay. Wow, so very fresh.
Exactly. And Carson Bradford, like I said, he was a man of money. He made his fortune, and he had moved his family down to Miami for the entertainment industry, again, amusement parks and such. And so he built this house on Lake Weir to kind of get away from the heat of the Miami summers. So they would come up to the house, you know, and kind of recreation there on the lake. And it was only 2 years before the shootout. Mm-hmm. His wife was very much against him renting it out, and he rented it out behind her back because he didn't want to turn down that money. I mean, like I said, $100 a month was unheard of for a rental house at the time. Sure. So, you know, there was no indication of any paranormal activity before this shootout. It was a house. Granted, it was a house that was built to the highest standards of the time. He spared no expense. And it's a large, I mean, still to today's standards, if you go into the house, it's very large. It's open. It had a beautiful front deck that looked out over the water. So a large porch, it was screened in, even at the time it was screened in, so people could sit on the porch and not be, you know, bothered by bugs or insects or anything like that. And you could look out over the water, had a large boat dock, so they could house the boats there. So even for the time, it was immaculate, to tell you the truth. So there was no paranormal activity before then.
So when the rumors started almost immediately of the paranormal activity around the house, I'm sure some of it really would just fall into urban legend and kids telling stories of the tragedy at this house. So naturally you have ghost stories. What, as far as your knowledge go, is the first somewhat detailed account, not just, oh, there's voices or we're hearing things or you know, just the generics. What is the first more detailed account that you've come across historically prior to your involvement in that period of it being, you know, the vacation house that you've discovered?
Well, Carson Bradford and his family, again, they went back to vacationing at the house. They cleaned it up. They left a lot of the bullet holes, but they covered them up with pictures. They left, like I said, a lot of the furniture still had the bullet holes and such. And so the reports are that, and I've heard interviews with them and I've read interviews with the family, that they would hear paranormal activity, footsteps going up and down the stairs, running from room to room at night, glasses clinking and such. So those were the reports, and they were actually, again, coming from the family. And so the family just essentially learned to live with it. You know, I don't know how sporadic they were or how frequent they were, but I have seen interviews and read interviews with the family saying that, yes, when they would vacation there, they would hear things of that nature.
Well, it's interesting to think of, because the Barkers are only there for a short period of time. It's not like it was their forever home or their homestead of some sort. So for all this activity to suddenly spark up and just get very active, you know, somewhat immediately after the incident, it makes you wonder, what is going on here? Why are these people, you know, there? And we can jump into that a little bit later in the talk. But then take us through closer to present day where the house sat, mm-hmm. and eventually let's go into what was the situation where there was kind of dispute of, well, who wants to take responsibility for this thing, and it ultimately moving to a new location. What exactly happened there, and what was the state of the home up to that point?
Well, the home was, again, in very good condition, and it was maintained that way. It, you know, to kind of get a visual, it's on a 2-lane country road that sits in Marion County there. Oklawaha is a very small little town. You know, it's got one stoplight. It's really a nondescript town. If you're not looking for it, you'll go right through it, essentially. But the house was always well-maintained, and the family just decided, you know, they'd held on to it for so long that they wanted to just kind of sell the land. And it was kind of a divide. I don't know if it was I'm not going to say it's a rift in the family divide, but there was some discussion on whether or not to either tear down the house and sell the property or sell the property with the house. It just so happened that the new owners that bought the property didn't want the house. They didn't, for some reason, I don't know what that reason was, they just didn't want the house. But Marion County Park and Recreation actually took it over, and the tax collector here, George Albright, was very instrumental in preserving the house and basically saying, this is a piece of our history. This, you know, this for a time put Oklawaha on the map. So we really want to preserve this. So the county paid the money to have the house floated across Lake Weir. And a company came in, a very professional company that, you know, apparently moves houses across the ocean, from what I've heard. And they jacked it up. They moved it with this huge tractor onto a barge. And they floated it across the lake. And it was such a gentle move that not even one brick from the chimney was moved. That's how gentle it was. And so they floated it probably about, I want to say about 2.5 miles, and they put it in a new resting spot in what's called Kearney Island, which is a county park. And the preservation efforts now include, you know, you can go in and actually visit the house at this time. They will have an interpretive center. They will have they're trying to bring it back to look exactly like the original property. So they'll have an old barn that was sitting beside the original house. There was a caretaker house, so they'll be building that and just really make it look exactly like it was the day of the shootout. So there's a lot of historical preservation efforts underway right now for the house.
Did the house, prior to its move in more present day, did any of the family that when they were staying there or using it as a vacation home have any accounts of paranormal activity in the house, or did it all just kind of go back to the earlier times closer to the shootout days?
No, they were reporting paranormal activity. Okay. You know, again, footsteps, yeah. Doors banging and stuff like that. It really became one of those things that they just kind of learned to live with, and, you know, didn't really talk about that much unless they were really asked point blank, is it haunted? So it was a lot of the speculation with regard to the paranormal activity came from the townspeople themselves, just kind of saying, hey, that's the Mont Barker house. Yeah, well, you know, my grandma heard that there was a ghost that was seen there. But again, the accounts that I really pay attention to are those that came from the Carson Bradford family directly. Sure. That said, yes, we went, you know, when we would stay here, we would hear these footsteps, we would hear these noises.
So at some point, obviously the house here is moved now. It's in the park area, mm-hmm. and in the restoration area. How mm-hmm. does the investigating in a more formal sense begin into the house, beyond just hearing the accounts from family who have stayed there over the years?
Okay, so what actually we did, and I'll say my group, is the first and the only group that has gotten permission to go in and do a paranormal investigation. You know, like I said, I am local to the area, and I think that it really appealed to the people that run the park and recreation there in Marion County. So they did permit us to go in. It was a 2-night investigation. And we were actually, what I wanted to do that night was I wanted to go in on the anniversary of the shootout. So we put equipment, night vision cameras, voice recorders and such in the house, and we left it to run stationary by itself from 9 o'clock at night all the way up till 9 the next morning, which encompassed the time that the shootout would have began. Because the shootout began January 16th, 1935 at about 6 a.m. So I wanted to really let the house be the house by itself, alone, without anybody in there, but still record any activity that may have happened, you know, that night. So what we actually found was, when we went back and looked at the evidence and listened to the audio that we caught, there were a lot of bangs and noise that I can't explain. And then in the room where Ma and Fred actually died, they were killed in an upstairs corner bedroom. They had barricaded themselves inside that room. They had two windows. So their thought was that they would have the high ground on the FBI agents, but they decided that they just were not going to be taken alive. So they ended up being killed, obviously, in that house. The voice recorder that we left at around 6:45 on the anniversary, that night we had the voice recorder, we caught what we believe is a female voice saying, "Freddie," and then a male voice saying, "What, Ma?" And then the female voice saying, "Get ready." And to me, that was an example of what I would consider residual haunting. Kind of like, this is the anniversary date. This is what happened. This is what was said right before they were killed. So we did capture a lot of that, what I would consider residual. And then we went back a week after that, and it was, I have 5 members on my team, but just 2 of us were there that night. So we went in, just the 2 of us in the house, and we had an amazing session with a spirit box. We were getting words like Alvin Karpis. We were getting words like Blackburn. Those words that are germane to the house, but wouldn't be to any other thing that was going on in, you know, the atmosphere. So, for example, you know, I don't think a radio station would randomly say the word Alvin Karpis when I'm asking the spirit box to give me the name of a gang member. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of that. We had a lot of what we call REM pod activity. I'm not sure how familiar you are with that piece of equipment, but it measures electronic energy. There is no power in the house at this time. So when we have our meters that measure energy, when it's responding to questions that we're asking, I took it as a very good sign that we were getting intelligent activity. And so, those are things that I cannot explain, but the house to us, that the night that we put equipment in, and then the night that we went back, was, in my mind, very active with paranormal activity.
Being from the area, knowing the legend of the house, knowing the story of the house, what did you expect? Mm-hmm. What were you thinking was going to happen when you went into investigating it?
To be honest with you, one of the main things that I wanted to see was, are the legends or the paranormal activity, is it to the land or to the house? A lot of what I was thinking was it was going to be to the house, and if we got any paranormal activity at all. So when we go into a location, we go in as skeptics, and you know, we try to debunk anything and everything. And if we have any question, we do not put that out as any type of what we would of unexplainable evidence to us. So the interesting thing about this house right now is it sits alone on 40 acres, and I'm talking in the middle of nowhere. So at night, there is zero light pollution. There is zero noise pollution. It's in a location that has been undisclosed because the Park and Recreation Department doesn't want vandals or anything going up there. So unless you're looking for this house, you're not going to find it. And unless you have a four-wheel drive vehicle, you're not going to get to it because of the Florida sand. So when I tell you that there's absolutely no outside interference or pollution, if you will, environmental pollution, I'm telling you, that's what it is like. It's the darkest place I've been to in a long time. So when we went in that night to put up the equipment, we were skeptical, and I honestly was not anticipating some of the evidence that we were able to capture that night, to be very truthful with it. And that's what led us to go back the second night, about a week later. It's because of the paranormal activity that we got the first night of just setting up stationary stuff. That's what led us to go back that second night.
With the evidence that you did get that first night, the EVPs of what you believe were so pertinent to the story of what happened. And obviously, to pick up anything is pretty amazing. But then to pick up things, names, and almost folks getting ready for what was about to happen on that fateful night so many years ago, in almost like a residual form, that had to have kind of blown your mind at that moment to be picking those things up. What is going through your mind as you get that, those pieces of evidence, and you're hearing these things, and you're at the very spot where, you know, in your mind, you might be thinking, wouldn't it be awesome if we suddenly heard like them discussing the shootout, and boom, you almost get that. You know, what's going through the minds of yourself and your fellow investigators when you're finding this out?
Honestly, we were blown away. I was not expecting, obviously you're hoping for it as a paranormal investigator. You're hoping to find that type of evidence. You know, I was, when I was listening to the audio, and just as a side note, when we go through the evidence, we are listening to every piece of audio that we recorded and every piece of video that we recorded. So when we have, you know, 5 voice recorders in this location and they're running for 14 hours, I'm listening to all of that audio. So it does take some time. So, at that point I was just kind of, you know, I was sitting at my desk, just kind of, I had the earphones on, and when it happened, again, I was blown away. And then when I cross-referenced what the time was, it was even more compelling because, again, that would have been the time exactly 84 years before that the shootout would have started. And in my mind, that would have been something that they would have said. You know, if they're noticing that there's movement outside, FBI agents coming around and surrounding the house, I would imagine that they would say, hey, get ready. We're going to start this shootout. We're going to do this thing. Get ready. Get to a window. Get your gun. Let's go. So to me, it was very compelling. It really was, because in my mind, it was something that would have been said that night. And then to follow up with that, the next night that we went, again, 1 week after the stationary equipment set up, when we were talking to the spirit box and we said, you know, can you give us a name? And the name Alvin Karpis, again, came through the spirit box. I can't explain that. You know, again, we're out in the middle of nowhere where AM, FM frequencies, it's hard to get them on a spirit box. So when it comes very clearly through Alvin Karpis, again, that's something I can't explain. When it says the name Blackburn, which is what they, the alias that they use to rent the house, when the name Blackburn comes through the spirit box, again, I can't explain that. And I don't think it'd be anything that a radio station would be talking about at the time. So, again, to me, that's very, very compelling.
That wraps up part one of our interview on the Ma Barker House with Christy Summer of Soul Sisters Paranormal. You can find out more about her group at soulsistersparanormal.com. In part two of our interview with Christy, we will talk about the land where the house once stood, and does it hold any ghost stories there? What went through Christy and her fellow investigators' mind when they heard the voices of the Barkers begin to talk about the shootout that happened more than 80 years ago during their investigation? Is the house haunted by the residual energy of that tragic day? Or do the intelligent spirits of the crime family still live in the Ma Barker house? Does anyone besides the spirit of the Barkers reside in the house today? Is there anything that seems to bring the spirits of the Barkers out of the shadows? Also, does Christy think the Barkers have a message that they want to get across to us today? And what would that message possibly be? We'll discuss all of that and more in part two of our interview. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.